Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I think this is episode 114. It's 9th of May 2025, and this week I was joined by Kate Santos, Clayne Glancy and Nia Roberts. Hello.
Hello.
So it was a good session, wasn't it? We had a lot of people on, and there was a lot. The chat was going bonkers. I just couldn't keep up with it. How did you find the session? I mean, it's your first session, Nia. How did you find it?
It was brilliant. I think getting the engagement from people joining in and asking loads of questions, but also providing their really invaluable experience. I think David had really, really good points when he came on. So I think it was brilliant, and it was just absolutely invaluable to get his input there as well.
This is the thing, you see, we're not trying to tell anybody or teach anybody. This is a community of very knowledgeable, experienced people, and I think they just want to get on and listen to each other and chew the fat on these types of things.
Yeah.
And sometimes reach out for support. You know, somebody was saying, oh, you know, does anybody ever get asked by their management team to review all the redactions? Almost like, does this ever happen to anybody else other than me? But it's just nice to know
feedback.
That.
Yeah.
So what about you, Kate? What was your top part of it?
I really enjoyed the session. I must admit I missed the podcast, so it's really good to be back. What I enjoyed the most, well, we discussed a lot about SaaS, in particular the employees, the next employees, etc. Where to look at, what is the business per usual and personal data, etc. But my favorite part was probably the discussion in the beginning about the attitude within the organization when the actually employee submits a SAR, and that normally can be or not as a suspicion, as a troublemaker. So I really enjoy that part of the session because I think it's important to raise awareness for that in specific, and as well the discussion that we have about the social media being part of the personal data to look as a data controller, in particular WhatsApp or Microsoft Teams, but more in the WhatsApp. I really, really enjoy that part. And yeah, what about you, Kane?
I thought it was a fantastic session. You know, as everyone said, it has been amazing to be back. It's felt like it's been a bit too long. It's been great to get back in front of everybody and, you know, have these discussions as a community as we do. I think they're truly invaluable to everybody, even us, even though we're the ones that spearhead them. But I really enjoyed the conversation specifically in relation to conflicts of interest and how we deal at first instance with these employee SARs, and instead of always looking at them as something that needs to be taken as someone who's trying to basically cause damage or is upset with the business, is maybe sometimes the case, but
yeah.
we do need to look at things in a different way and be truly impartial in how we deal with these things, because it's very easy for all sorts of emotions and feelings to get involved when it is the case, when it's people that you work with. You know, it is truly a difficult circumstance, and I think, you know, as everybody in the chat can likely attest to, as it was a busy one, but it is something that everybody struggles with in the space. So I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk about it.
We touched on Manifestly Unfounded and Excessive, didn't we? That whole notion of proportionality, which is again a good discussion, and there's now some interesting case law we referred to, which is good. Nia was promoting the ICO's excellent website. So
Hill says for a great team.
But pretty quickly she said no.
I have to say my that we didn't spend much time talking about it. My favourite about this, I love talking about the SaaS, but the kind of talking about the security around the M&S and the co-op breaches, because there's such a lot in there, you know. And actually, you know, I think one of the fundamental weaknesses in the co-op was that they got attacked through their Teams chat functions. So you know, we're talking Teams, we're talking chat, we're talking WhatsApp, all these tools for helping productivity, and, you know, are they within the scope of the SaaS? Some of them are just potentially, you know, weak backdoors into our systems.
That's, I think it definitely kind of showcases that you need really, really good relationship between your IT team and your data protection teams.
definitely. Right, well, I think we should let these the listeners dive into the session. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy it. Right, very good. So we're delighted that Nia's here. We're going to follow the same format as usual, which is a bit of a run through the news and maybe a talk about some of the interesting things that have passed our desk, and then we're going to get stuck into the main session. But Nia, very good welcome to our podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. It's lovely and sunny over here in Manchester. And yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you very much for letting me on.
So do you want to just give a quick intro, you know, where you're from and what you're
doing? My name is Nia Roberts. I am the head of risk and compliance over at Woodgate & Clark. And we are a loss adjusting firm. So work in the financial services loss and insurance industry. So that's where I'm from. And I have a very, very, very big passion for data protection. So.
Well, you're joining a community of people with exactly the same feeling. And if anybody else ever wants to come on, you know, we don't have to come on individually, you can come on as a group or whatever, then we're always looking for people to come on and you know, join us and speak and express their opinions and share their experiences. So, what have you seen in the news? Anything interesting? Obviously, the Co-op and the M&S breaches, they've been big news. What have you seen? Anything interesting?
I mean, I know you wanted to talk a little bit on the M&S stuff, Phil, but Kate came across this really interesting news piece that we've been talking about that kind of unnerved me slightly, to be honest, reading it. It was about a man called Chris Pelkey. He was actually shot to death in a road rage accident, which is obviously has gone to court in Arizona. Now, something quite, I suppose, interesting happened in the court case was that they used AI to sort of present Mr. Pelkey to the judge and obviously to the perpetrator with the words obviously not being his own, but using AI to recreate his sort of voice recordings that he's had from his family. So in terms of honoring his voice and how he looks, but followed sort of a script, I guess, written by his sister about how he believed in, you know, forgiveness, and sort of mentioned stuff relating to the case, which is just feels awfully strange
it's
to me.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's very bizarre, quite dystopian.
That's very strange.
To be honest.
It's really weird.
But in my mind, it's left a bit of a weird feeling. I was just like, in terms of considering, obviously, this is meant to be the voice of Chris Pelkey, but in what way does it show his feelings in that sense, considering it has come from his sister, who admittedly probably knows him very well, but do we know that for certainty? Obviously, deceased individuals don't fall under the scope of the GDPR, but I do still think it is a really interesting concept, and probably not one I'd be welcome to seeing. The judge thinking quite the opposite and thinking it was quite a worthwhile addition, but I do think it does set quite a strange precedent for speaking on behalf of a dead person as them. Like it was just very odd to me, but it does show the power of AI, I suppose.
It's really weird. I mean, here is obviously trying to reconstruct like a person post-mortem. The GDPR is not applicable to deceased people, but I mean, they, in the statement, they include date of the living relatives and the voices and big statements, etc. And if I remember correctly, while I was reading the news, apparently the relatives provided their consent actually to this statement to exist and, well, to come here. And just came like with a question, like, can actually consent be actually informed even if the data subject itself cannot obviously provide because, well, is that so? I don't know, a lot of questions, and I feel that it's very, very bizarre, this situation here. I really, really think so.
Very odd. That's why I thought it was
a moral argument.
Yes,
a moral argument of that as well. And I just find if we're going to be utilizing that in courts of law, morally, is it right?
I mean, I believe. It also changed the rule, and I believe he instead got 10 and a half years
for manslaughter.
Instead of what may have been murder instead, depending on the circumstances. So obviously the fact that this AI has been used has significant consequences and could have significant consequences if it is something that they want to use further. So I did think it was something really interesting to bring to light, because in my opinion, I'm really against it, but. You know, I do understand the uses of AI, and I could see the benefit, but at the same time, I think it does set a dangerous precedent sometimes.
That's good. I saw another. I'm not sure if it's on this. Sorry, Phil.
Nice. Carry on. Don't mind me.
I was just mentioning that I saw like in news as well today that there was a 6 months extension for the UK adequacy decision. So apparently the European Data Protection Board's opinion that was requested by European Commission addressed the proposed extension of the UK adequacy decision, which, if it does not happen, apparently will expire on the 27th of June this year. So the 6 months extension proposal will go until 27th of December, so until the end of this year. But apparently it was just a proposal. Let's see what comes through it. Just making sure, because I forgot completely. Obviously it would be this year, but I forgot that will be just, we're already in May. So the adequacy decision is important to have because of the DUA bill to be approved or not. That apparently is in the third reading, is it not? I heard that.
Yeah, everyone's reckons it's going to go through and it'll be implemented in the spring. But I think that it's got a very good chance of getting through. On a kind of related note, I read a quite interesting short blog about does Trump change our view of risks using US cloud providers, you know, and the likelihood of the authorities accessing the data for a variety of different purposes. So that I haven't really read through it or thought it through, but I just read it literally before I came on here. So again, that's there's quite a lot, I think, moving parts, aren't there?
No, I agree.
Yeah, I'm interested in the
receiving use.
Yeah, in Peter's question about the Vatican, whether it's got its own supervisory authority, which maybe we'll come back to. But the M&S thing's been interesting, hasn't it? So that's affecting M&S, the Co-op, and apparently Harrods as well. But it seems that from what I've read, and I've read quite a bit about it today, according to Bleeping Computer, the social engineering attack was a password reset from a remote worker. So it kind of throws into relief, you know, lots of questions about remote workers and about password reset protocols, which, to be fair, when we're doing PCI DSS audits, you know, there has to be a documented password. We have to test it. We have to demonstrate that it's robust, or client does to us. But you know, when we're doing GDPR audits, you know, do we go into that level of detail? Do we say, how does your password reset protocol work? You know, how do you verify the identity of the person making the request? And with so many people working from home, you know, they are a significant weakness. And then I've got quite a lot of, if anyone's interested, quite a lot of reading and resources, blogs, articles about this kind of whole topic. But it's a big, big area of weakness. Now, I read the NCSC's and NIST's password policies, and the NCSC is suggesting three random words as being your best policy for passwords. NIST is saying a minimum of 64 characters.
Wow.
And not to use them for the same password ever. So they've all got to be unique for every single account you've got, which is quite some challenge.
I did see an interesting like graph on that. I think I seen it on LinkedIn that was like the seconds it would take to like guess a password based on like character length and things included on it. It was saying like it was like six characters and it was just letters. Like it takes like 10 seconds or something like
that. It's ridiculously fast.
Which is absolutely mental when you think about it like that. Obviously, I think sometimes a lack of care is more from a personal perspective, just from people in passwords as a whole that they use for things, is just because people don't want to forget their passwords. It seems like a hassle remembering them, but at the same time, they are truly so important.
Well, they're often the key to the door. Again, when we're doing audits and we say, you know, how you protect, and then people, we've got multi-factor authentication. Well, the obvious next question is on what systems?
On what? Yeah.
You know, and how does it work? Now, interestingly, Harrods have reported they've had attempted attacks as well, but they've managed they've been resilient. They managed to bounce, you know, the attacks have bounced off. And again, that makes me think about incident reporting. So where this audit was doing on Wednesday in this hospital, you know, I was asking about incident reporting, and it's not really there. They get hot about breaches, but not, you know, incidents, you know, things that have occurred, like an attempted login should be logged as an incident, because a pattern might emerge. You know, there's no point just recording the stuff that results in a security breach. You've got to record everything so you can see over time patterns emerging. So I think there's an awful lot. We could do a whole session just talking about this.
Yeah.
So let's put in this password cracker. Also, we're all around on multi-factor authentication. You know, it's flawed. Now, for $6, you can buy a piece of software called called Software Shark, I think it's called, and it will bypass. It'll place a cookie, use session cookies to find out, you know, the tokens, and can bypass multi-factor authentication. So, you know, we're up against a moving attack force, and we've got to be mobilized. And again, I read some other stuff just before I came on about what do we think about security under GDPR. And I think we should have a session on that, because I just don't think we go far enough. What is appropriate? You know, what's appropriate security? And I don't think we go far enough. Personally, what I found in doing audits, we leave it with IT. We don't go far enough to say, why is this appropriate? Why is not that appropriate? And
I agree. I mean, Amy in the chat is doing a very interesting point, saying it's because for most companies, see data protection and information security is a tick box exercise rather than a genuine concern. And it's true. And I think in terms of securities and passwords and multi-factor authentication is something that obviously I feel always a little bit uneasy, because with one side, we have the password that need to be protected and should be renewed every single time with these three questions, very personal questions. But I was just thinking, like, if it's possible, like, require a multi-factor verification before a password being resetted, for example, in that way we can just verify the identity of someone, the person that's actually resetting the password. I don't know. I just feel like every single time that we hear about a cyber attack nowadays, they are just so smart.
Because security is a layered thing, you've got to assume that passwords are going to get cracked and that people are going to get in, so therefore you've got to get to the next layer of security. Well, how are you going to restrict the amount of data that can get damaged? You know, how are you going to stop software being installed on a local device? You know, again, when we go out, one of the questions we ask people doing an audit is, you know, are the users of devices administrators on those devices? And you know, if they are, then what's to stop somebody installing? Of course, if you start throwing into the mix, bring your own device, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Anyway, we're running out. We're not going to talk about this.
We surely would have a whole session on this.
But you remember we talked a few weeks ago about a Telegraph report, an army of fake North Korean IT workers infiltrating UK companies, masquerading as remote work. Well, they are remote workers and getting jobs in IT, you know, because they're experienced and cheap. And, you know, again, what background checks are we doing on people? Anyway, enough. I saw that in the news. A lot of stuff all linked together, but.
No, absolutely. Should we jump on to the topic at hand? I think, because I feel like it will be a long one regardless. Which is obviously the joys, or maybe not so much for some of the listeners, of employee SARS.
Yeah, and the big smile on the ear.
Yeah.
So where do you want to start? Where do you want to start with this? I think there's a lot of relevant stuff to talk through, and I know we're going to run out of time on it. So, you know, where do you want to start with this? You know, obviously knows what a SAR is, and you know, so on and so forth. But
yeah, of course. I think what might be beneficial for the listeners, and one of the joys of having Nia here, is obviously us at DPP we are all external, but it would be very nice to get. So just a little bit of an opinion on Nia on how she feels about employee SARS, if there's anything particularly at the moment that she feels like she's having any difficulties with, anything she's noticed in the organization that she works at. And I think from there we can sort of just go, and I think snowball, and all sorts of things will come from it, I think. But I think that's probably starting place number one.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, that sounds great with me. I think the key thing with employee SARS, when they come in, I think there is always this in everywhere that I've worked, it's that panic. It's that, oh my God, what do I do? Oh no. So I think the key message is don't panic. Don't panic. It's all going to be okay. I think taking that personalization as well out of when you receive an employee subject access request, it's of course going to be it's usually because either something's gone wrong, someone wants to find some information about, they're unhappy with the decision perhaps. So it's taking that personal, personal away from it by saying, having a bit of empathy for the employee, but also having a bit of an empathy for the individual dealing with it. So I think in some organisations, larger organisations may have a data protection officer or someone, head of risk and compliance, who deals with subject access requests. But some organisations may have, you know, a HR manager or a director who usually is in charge of data protection, but doesn't know the ins and outs as well as perhaps maybe they could. So using things like external consultancies, the ICO website as well, which is my favourite website. They've got an absolutely fantastic question and answer section on specifically on employee subject access requests. What you can send, what you can't really send, and where you need to have that justification. So I think the key message really for it is have a little bit of empathy with the person requesting it. It's not a nuisance. They have the right to access their data. But also don't panic. You know, there's people there to help you and there's loads of resources out there to support as well.
No, you raise such a good point, I think, about empathy of the requester. I think it's really easy and probably quite common for people to see these requests coming from data subjects and immediately maybe fob it off as, you know, someone trying to cause trouble, someone trying to be a nuisance, and, you know, general element of sort of distaste, I guess, the fact that this SAR has been made, because obviously they know that it's going to take some time, and in their head they see it as all like they're trying to waste our time, or like we have to spend all this time doing this. They know that they're trying to cause a nuisance, but, you know, that it may be cases where that is the case, but it, you know, this right exists for a reason. You know, fundamentally the GDPR exists to allow individuals to understand what happens to their personal data and allow for personal data to be processed lawfully. So it is always really important to understand from the perspective of an employee why they're feeling like that they have to make a SAR. You know, this could come from many reasons, not always to see, you know, what people are saying about them, but maybe they're, you know, seriously concerned about the way that their data has been handled, or they truly do want to exercise their right. It's not an easy thing to pass off as just, you know, this person is just trying to cause a bother.
Well, where do we stand when we believe it's a kind of a secondary purpose, that it's you know, a misuse of process? You know, they're on a phishing exercise because there's some sort of grievance that they want to try and find out about. That's often the case, isn't it? The first thing to do is to plop in a SAR, see what we've got.
I think in here, obviously, when we know that there is a dispute or grievance or disciplinary case, they still have the right to do it. So the motive of why they are doing or exercising the rights under the UK GDPR normally is relevant. Obviously, we need to, as an organisation, when we receive a SAR, always need to understand, obviously, if the request is manifestly unfounded or excessive, if there are any reductions that need to be done to protect third parties, this and that. But I feel that trying to understand the motive that is behind the request, obviously, internally could be, well, relevant or not, even just for the empathy and trying to understand if there is something that they can actually do internally. But they have, again, what Nia was saying, and very, very correctly, is that the right exists and is still there, whatever the reason. This is my opinion. And I think the principle, the organizations, even if they understand that probably there is a dispute or something, should just avoid to be defensive or trying to buy a war with the employee or the ex-employee, because in the end of the day, the right exists. And if they try to, I don't know, to delay the response or not, or do like incomplete SARs, etc., could actually, they could be fined. Actually, already the ICO already did it in terms of a few organizations that actually like delayed in the response, and the SAR itself was incomplete before an employee, they actually find it. So it's something that they need to avoid. But it's really hard. I think it's so easy for us to talk about this and very straightforward. But when we are dealing with it, it's so tricky.
Yeah, I mean, and impartiality is tough. And I do still agree with the people in the comments saying, you know, they are coming from disputes in all nature. And of course they will. You know, I think a lot of the time, until really recently, people aren't really aware of SARs, on, like, as a, you know, member of the public. maybe more so until recently, but they only really come to light in nature of these disputes, you know, where they have spoke to people and they feel like they need to reach out to people to potentially get answers. And yes, maybe in some instances it's been, it could be used in a weaponized way. I mean, I don't really like that term. It makes it sound more malicious than it is, I think. But I do think, obviously, people might use them for their own gain. But at the same time, the right obviously stands. And it is the case that, you know, people still do want to know what happens with the data, and they have the right to know it, whatever the sort of the justification behind that seems to be. But it is hard as a DPO or as someone involved in risk or whoever sits at that level to deal with these SARs is like the impartiality of it, I suppose, and being able to step away.
I think the ICO's guidance actually is pretty good on this, actually. They've improved it a lot. And, you know, they do actually go into a bit of detail about how to consider whether something is manifestly unfounded or excessive. But I mean, to counter your point about how marvelous their website is, Nia, they were referring to a particular enforcement notice, First Choice Selection Services, who were served with an enforcement notice for failing to respond to a SAR on the basis that it was going through an employment tribunal. Well, I could not find that enforcement notice anywhere because the ICO seems to knock them off their website after a couple of years. I did find it, if anybody's interested, I did find it in some sort of murky archive of various documentation. But, you know, why are they doing that? You know, we're privacy practitioners and we need this stuff, you know, not just the recent stuff. We need it all because we need to read it and make sure that we understand all the cases as they evolve. So it really frustrates me that they take stuff down off their website when it's still relevant to us in you know, who are trying to do the job that they want us to do. It irritates me.
And take your praise back.
No, you can issue praise for the SAR part of the website, but yes, not for the action we've taken part.
I have a question in terms of just picking now that we have a SAR, and imagine that we have a SAR. I think it's quite straightforward in terms of where to look at when we receive a SAR and review the personal data. I think in terms of employees or ex-employees, automatically we go to emails, HR records, probably performance reviews, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that I normally come across, two things from this. So we can have employees that are employed for the past 20, 25 years in your organization. So in terms of retention periods, as Amy is mentioning, is something that we need to, I think, is relevant to discuss here, because large volume of data, because they are employed for such a long time, wow, they can talk about a lot of personal data. And the second one is the fact that normally when I come across a SAR, and when one of our customers came to us to request for assistance in terms of SAR employees, etc., normally the data that came back to us is always emails, HR records, and that's it, unless they actually require something in specific, opinions, comments, reports, anything. But came across a question, because Article 15 mentioned all the data, so all personal data that involve obviously the data subject, employee, etc. So would not, for example, CCTVs, SS logs, well, obviously messaging from Teams and WhatsApp, and I think we'll go through it in a second as well, all of this should not be actually involved, call recorders if it exists, and then probably the differentiation between business as usual and the personal data. But I think that's sometimes we just go through directly to the emails and HR records and forget about the rest of the categories of personal data. And I would just like to hear your thoughts on this, in particular, Nia, on you. I'm not sure if you, in terms of management, where to look at, if you do, what do you do, what is normally your process?
I think especially around things like social media, for example, Microsoft Teams, WhatsApp, those kind of things. I think it's really, really important, especially if you have either a bring your own device policy, which includes the use of your mobile phones for business, or if you're provided with a company mobile phone. I think it's really important to not forget those bits. With CCTV, it's so difficult because you are going to, unfortunately, it is part of personal data. So you could, you know, we are allowed to seek clarity of if that is something that the individual would like to see. Would you like to see CCTV? Usually it's more kind of about the documentary evidence rather than the CCTV that they are looking for. So they may come back and say no, but it's also receiving the consent of others who may be on that CCTV. I think that is quite key as well, because mm-hmm. it's not just going to be that one individual that is appearing on that tape for however long.
Yeah, I think this will be, would involve not only a lot of redactions, as is mentioned in the chat, but as well, I think probably the criteria of being what is the search that should be proportionate and reasonable, I think is where this comes through. Yeah. Because I'm not sure if a SAC comes in, I think...
Well, if images are material to the SAR, then obviously mm-hmm. it's important to do. If they're not, then it's not important to do. So I think that gets... or can influence the, you know, the reasonable proportionate measures. You know, what measure. If you can boil down what is the SAR about, you know, and it, surely it's not, I just want to see what you've got. I mean, that, you know, if it's driven by some sort of grievance, there's going to be something. Now, it could be that someone's been accused of something that they know is caught potentially on camera. So they want to, they want to see, they want evidence. They want to see what, you know, they might not want it for the right reasons. They might want it to prove that they didn't do anything wrong or something. And we've had that loads of times, actually. I remember a big retailer we were working with. SAR came in, you know, delivery driver, you know, abusing member of staff. And this was a retail outlet. So you had a security firm contracted by a retail provider who sublets all the space to brands. And it was a brand member of staff complaining about a delivery driver to a different brand. And they were all kind of mixed up in, oh, should we disclose this or shouldn't we disclose this? Because there's all these four different entities involved. So, you know, but ultimately, you know, it could be really important or it could be frivolous.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do just... Oh, sorry, Nia.
I was just going to say, receiving clarity from the individual. If someone's emailed in going, I've got a subject access request, send me my file. I think, you know, if they've been working for a long period of time, it is completely acceptable to go back and be like, so can I just clarify, what is it that you want? Mm-hmm. What is it that you need? Is there anything specifically, any date ranges that you'd like me to look at? And receiving that clarity from them, I think helps them feel perhaps maybe more listened to, that it's being taken seriously, and then allows us to really, really focus that search on the information that they require.
The search is a difficult one, isn't it?
Yes.
From employees that have been there for 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, Fiona's point, again, a good point is made, and the problem is that colleagues don't want to disclose their reasons for the SAR a lot of the time. Well, maybe they don't trust us. Maybe they think that there's a hand up here. Maybe they think that there is more ground for refusing it if they're clear about what the purpose is.
If they disclose what that reason is. Yeah.
So, I don't know. There was Esther.
I don't know if you want to jump in. Yeah.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to touch a bit on SAR based on my personal experience, is that when it comes to like HR SAR, obviously like Nia has said, it's most time it's just a phishing exercise. And one of my experience is we had one whereby the data subject listed very explicitly what they were looking for. And when we gave them everything, they made another one disputing it. And then in that same dispute, they added new SAR. So the way I handled it was more like we had to like draw up a table to say we've done this, this is new, and then go back to the data subject to say we've actually given you all the data that you want, however this is a new set of SAR requests that you've made and we're going to action it as a new one and then apply like the new 30 days to it because we're already out of time for the previous one.
Yeah, which is fair if it's a new request in nature and context, to be fair. I think people do that a lot, don't they? I think I've seen it working in the educational sector that there's a lot of SARs made on top of SARs a lot of the time, and it's knowing when to consider it a new SAR.
Yeah, and it's a lot. And another thing I have found that HR practitioners who handle data subject access requests is they tend to bury data subject in a load of BAU information. because it's more for them as a payback. And when you look at, let's say it was a grievance or a disciplinary procedure that went bad, and they, you know, it's like revenge, but in a very subtle way. So in order to make the data subject, in order to get them frustrated with the whole process, hoping they would drop the SAR, they end up piling up more information into it. Mm-hmm. And then the redaction then takes a whole lot of time because you're saving, like I've seen one of almost 1,000 and half of it was BAU. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, we cannot do that. So I just think that, you know, HR practitioners need to be trained. Yes, it might be vindictive from the data subject, but it's still a SAR. Like what Katrina said, it's still a SAR. They do have a right to do it, and there's really nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I suppose in most cases, yeah, that is no, absolutely right, Esther. David, I know you have your hand up as well. I don't know if you want to, like, add on to what Esther's saying or it's relevant to the topic. So if you want to, like, jump on and maybe disagree, maybe agree, I don't know. Just interested to get your thoughts.
I think this is killing me to have to drop off this call because I think Philip knows this is probably my favourite subject. I speak on this quite a lot in both sides. So I work for a very large multinational company. I have a lot of employees globally. I own the teams who do SARs across all of Europe. So I have to balance European requirements. I think the biggest challenge in the UK is, and we're seeing it go full circle on one at the moment, which is really interesting, is most employees believe that a SAR is legal discovery and they will see everything that they would see if they get legal discovery. And it is far from legal discovery. In fact, I'm sat here holding tone. I'm sure Nia does many of these things, but, you know, I wouldn't even contemplate looking at 20 years. My searches are proportionate for my organization. We're huge. We couldn't do that. Yeah, we do exactly. We ask people for guidance. If they don't define guidance, I will work out what I think is proportionate. I'm willing to be challenged. And we have, and as yet, touch wood, you know, we've had a few conversations. It's not gone bad. I definitely wasn't happy with the lady who feels that HR, I sit under HR's very senior leadership. So I'm part of that organization as well. So, you know, I'd hope we're not misleading. I mean, we have a position that we'll provide everything that we find in our searches. We do proportionate searches, but I ain't going to search 110,000 different mailboxes. I'll search that I believe those that are appropriate for what's been asked for what they've got. So mm-hmm. We will do a proportionate search and we'll provide everything that goes with it. But we will also, and I think the biggest thing is, lots of them in dispute are looking for the wording around your investigation processes. We don't give any of that. You know, we've got external legal guidance to cover our own position. Our own position is covered by data given in confidence, which is on, go look on the ICO's website. Mm-hmm. We exempt lots of that data at different points in time on different things. So we look at the appropriate exemptions and we give them what they, you know, what is appropriate, but where there is a misuse or other things. But at the moment we've got, we had a quite significant SAR. We gave them lots of information. That case has ended up, not the SAR part of it, because it wasn't related to the court case. We knew it was coming, but it was separate things. We now have an ETA, Employment Tribunal, and the discovery deck has materials that we didn't give in the SAR. And we're having to defend, and we decided to do that. Well, we could say it just wasn't there, but we're having to go through the discovery deck and our SAR and identify what documents we didn't give and why we didn't give them. A lot are exactly that they were part of the investigation process. But other things that you never told us about this, we had no reason to go looking that area because you never told us. Mm-hmm. Now it becomes different when it gets to legal and we're doing full legal discovery and different things. So yeah, I think that's a challenge that I see frequently. And I'm going to have to go because people are pinging me to join another meeting. But this absolutely is my favourite topic. I know, it's disastrous. Well, you put it in quite late, having missed them for a month. So I've missed you guys, and I'm sure I'll be back. Anyway, I will leave you to it. And
nice to talk to you.
Nice to speak to you all.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, David. We appreciate it.
I was just going to say, I do completely agree with David in terms of some people do think that a subject access request is similar to a legal disclosure, a discovery. Yeah. And it's really, really not. It's two completely different things. Mm-hmm. But also to remember as well, when the legal discovery is done, it's not sent to the data subject, it's sent to their legal representative. That may be passed over to the data subject. However, it does go to their legal representative. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of points were interesting points were raised, like the amount of times that we need to explain to individuals that a SAR involves only personal data related to the data subject, not all the information or something specific, yes. is abysmal. And as well, if we are talking about the retention periods, I'm super adhered to the fact that, for me, if we actually provide with the information, with a response letter attached to the information provided, explaining the rationale, and if there are exemptions that are applicable, and the fact that probably, for example, CCTV, this and that, could be obviously as a personal data, but we are not doing this because we don't feel that is interesting for the case or for the request itself. But if we inform, be transparent with the data subject, I think is the best card, because normally they are looking for something specific that in principle will be already included in the SAR and the data that will be protected to them. But I mean, if we be transparent with a companion letter explaining the rationale, exemptions that were applicable, why, and for example, I had a case in the terms of emails, rather than just say, well, we have just explain all emails and just provided them all the redactions, for example, we can just present like a sample and say we have 2,500 emails with this, exactly this information, a sample, that's it.
Now, that's an interesting kind of thought, really, is that what you're suggesting is that it's not necessarily a big bang, here's all the stuff. Maybe it's actually a process. You know, here's some of it, do you want any more of this type of stuff? You know, so, but that's not our approach. That's not the guidance, and that's not how Article 15 is phrased, is it? But it's interesting because we've had no SARs for 9 years. We've had four in the last fortnight. One was served on us as a processor to one of our customers in our SAR bureau. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's we're a process. The process don't have to respond to SARs. You know, we referred it back to the controller. But you know, I've approached those because we've not had any. I've approached it as like, I'm going to test our systems work. You know, can we find stuff in our systems? Yeah, we can. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, can we respond? Can I open up a dialogue with these individuals to try and help them get what they want? And so far, that's proved to be quite productive. You know, but as I say, it's a novelty, thankfully, for me.
Yeah. No, and it's good. I suppose it's good to be able to know that there is security in those systems in the event that we need them. But obviously it's the case that we're probably not going to look, luckily. There's one thing I did want to
there's
back
loads
off.
In the chat as well. There's loads in the
no,
chat.
No, I know the chat is going absolutely on, yes. barren, but someone was mentioning something along the lines of, I think it was Kate and Nia sort of jointly probably talking about when like third party data is involved. I think a key thing I want to talk on that I see a lot is in SARs at the moment, especially in relation to employee disputes, is specifically requesting or asking for somebody else's emails. So saying, I want to see every email from so-and-so in HR, Phil Brynan in HR. I want to see every email that Phil Brynan sent that relates to me. Now, immediately to me, this is just a red flag already in terms of like, you know for certainty who is sending the context of these emails. You already know based on the fact that you're asking from these emails, regardless of irrespective of the redactions that we do and the content of what we see, how heavily redacted it is, it's kind of irrelevant because you already know who's saying these things regardless. So to me, that's already probably a big no-no. And I think there probably is ways of seeing it, but I think in the nature in which they've asked it, they've kind of shot themselves in the foot almost. In the nature of which they've asked it almost by saying I want so and so.
I think there's definitely more chance of people being to derive who a commentator is from an internal SAR than there is from an external SAR. So you know you're trying to protect people's identity through their names and their identifiers as well as what's said and how it's said and when it's said and also and so forth. But in the employment context, because certainly in a small organization, everyone knows what language people use and you know so on and so forth. So there's more chance of having to redact more in order to protect the individual's identity who's making those comments that you think were made in confidence or there's a good reason to withhold them.
They definitely are much more complex to me than like externally made SARs from customers and tenants. You got to go through everything with such care and consideration. And on top of likely sometimes internal politics from other members of staff, like higher up senior members of staff who don't want certain information disclosed, which may need to be, especially in relation to disputes and tribunals. You do sometimes occasionally see pressure from people at the top of the organization who don't want to see certain things. I mean, I've seen that a handful of times with some of the customers that I know, and it's again quite a difficult game for whoever is in the position of doing that SAR. Yeah. And can be seriously complex.
Now, David Sawsons earlier in the day has chatted through the use of exemptions, and specifically Schedule 2, Part 1, Paragraph 7.2, which I'd had a quick look at. I actually looked at it yesterday when I was feeding back on a particular query that came up in this hospital audit I was doing. So this is an exemption which applies to a variety of different parts of the UK GDPR. But if a function is designed to protect the public against dishonesty, malpractice or other seriously improper conduct or unfitness or incompetence. Now, only applicable if such rights are conferred on a person by an enactment or a function of the Crown, a minister of the Crown or a government department, or if it is of public nature and is exercised in the public interest. Now, David was specifically referring to local authorities dealing with internal investigations and grievances, which I'm not sure would be of a public nature. But again, there's some of these exemptions that we're working with are a little bit hard to get your head round. But I think what I saw a note flash up on the chat earlier on, which said, you know, make sure you justify your rationale in your case. So in a way, you can interpret this the way that you know, as long as it's justifiable and justifiable and rational, you kind of put your right, well, you think it means this. Document that down, test it, you know, and then if you get challenged on it, you've got some. We went through a thought process, you know, in the absence of anything else, we took advice. And this. So I'm not entirely sure, without going into the specifics, about whether that particular exemption is applicable in those circumstances, but they're there in the back of the DPA, aren't they, to be used as and when we need it. And somebody talked about legal professional privilege earlier, and I've put a reference into the Law Society's paper on legal professional privilege, which is really good because it explains the two types: legal professional privileges, legal advice privilege, and litigation privilege, and when they do and don't apply, and how you can undermine your legal professional privilege by sharing that information too broadly in your organization. So then they come with a lot of caveats of these exemptions. I don't know if you had much experience, Nia, of dealing with the exemptions.
Not so much the exemptions. I think we've really tried to provide as much as possible with it within the guidelines. But no, not in terms of exemptions, especially around legal professional privilege, those kind of things. It's not really something that we've been fortunate enough to delve into.
I mean, mostly it's down to management forecasting, part, yeah. You know, yes. It's about negotiations, it's about confidential references, usually in the employment context, isn't it?
I think in terms of kind of whistleblowing reports, I think there was a case a couple of years ago that I assisted on, a fair few years ago now. So it was that kind of using the protection of the person whistleblowing the issue to not provide that information, and that ended up being all fine. There were no issues there. I think the individual did make a call to the ICO, who confirmed that we were in the right. But I think that's also quite an important one in terms of whistleblowing, protecting the rights of the whistleblower, the Public Interest Disclosure Act.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. There's another comment in here about what's everyone's thoughts about seniors, which they're not referring to people like me with lots of grey hair. They're talking about senior people in organisations wanting the final overview. Now, this puts the data protection officer in an awkward position, really, because we might be saying, and I have been in this position, you know, there's no reason to withhold this information. A chief exec says, well, I don't want it disclosing. Okay. Fine. And my advice is it should be disclosed. No lawful backgrounds for not disclosing it. But I don't think we can. We know that we're going to be told. Let's say we're told to do something we know is not right. That as a professional, that's really hard to accept. I think we probably have to accept it. I think we probably have to accept it. We have to make sure that we, are covered as a hand up it. But it's hard, isn't it? I mean, and I'll come back to you in a second, Janice. I know I go on about the Jamaican Data Protection Act a lot because I would do some work with it. But in the Jamaica Data Protection Act, there's a requirement for the DPO to report non-compliances as well as personal data breaches to the supervisory authority. Now, nothing exists like that in the GDPR, which I think is an omission. But, you know, what do you do in those circumstances? Janice, you might have the answer, or you might have another question.
No, I think I've got to think. It's not actually happened to me under SAR. It has happened to me under FOI that I completely disagreed with the exemptions that were being cited. So I just get the chief executive to sign it and send it out the door.
I think that's probably the best approach. You got to sometimes accept, you know, they're just ignoring me. I know I'm right, and they're ignoring me. And as long as I'm not on the hook professionally, you know, I've credited myself and all that kind of stuff, then I think you have no option. But you can't get all worked up about it. I think that's
I imagine there's only so far it can go at the end of the day. If your big boss wants something doing, then you can disagree, of course, and professionally, if you make it clear that you think it's the right thing to disclose it, their decision will still probably be final. It's just making sure that if that's their decision, it is made probably
just
quite clear
make
that
sure
it is their
you keep the evidence.
Make sure keep your evidence. Is that
absolutely. Yeah.
Keep a register of your decision and the evidence that they disagree on you.
I think the question, Rebecca, is if this happened to you, you're not the only one. That's reassuring to know that it happens to us all, and we're all put in this awkward position. And we, you know, what we've got to do is accept that that is the case, and we've just got to make sure we protect ourselves and our organisations as far as we can. Now, the chief exec could be corrupt; he could end up going to prison, you know, or something like that. So, you know, we might be the guardians of the org as well as our own careers. Mm-hmm. But it is a tricky position to be in.
And I think
Amy
probably makes a pretty good point on just on the senior element of it, of wanting oversight, not necessarily to make a decision on the data, but to see what is going out in the event that something may come back, or it is in relation to a dispute or an employee tribunal. That makes quite a lot of sense to me, I think. Having an instances like that, you know, being able to prepare is really important, especially in relation to disputes and tribunals. It is deeply important in those sort of elements to make sure that if it is the case that they want to get ready, then fine. I think the difficulty comes in saying like, oh, let me have a look at that just in case. You know, we'll leave this one aside. I don't think we want them to see that. I think that's where the complications come in. But I do think that instances like that do make sense.
Mm-hmm. I want to just throw another thing in here. So one of the phrases that I know, I think I understand it, but I'm not sure I like the way it's banded around sometimes, is this business as usual data. You know, what do we mean by that? You know, what is it we can say? Oh, we're excluding that because that's business as usual data. And I hear that said quite a lot. Again, I don't know what people's thoughts are about that.
I think it's such a broad term. I think what would be useful, and it's probably not going to be done in every organisation, but defining that in your data protection policy under your subject access request statement, saying, this is how organization XYZ defines business as usual data, I think would be probably a really good place to start. But then it is up to each individual organization to define that and have that documented there.
Yeah, I think in business per usual can be so tricky sometimes because the communications normally is around communications and to try to understand and separate what is actually personal information, what's actually professional on the professional context is so tricky. And for example, like I do remember was just a very recent one was something like an example, an email about, for example, the project status that obviously is not a personal data unless that actually the email about even about the project probably can contain some evaluative comments
this project,
about the requester.
Why is this project off target? Why is it project
exactly
over budget?
So it's depend. I think it's actually assessment that we need to do case by case, and it's so tricky because an email that obviously can be in a professional context can actually include personal data of the employee as an employee, but actually relates to him is personal data. So it's very, very tricky. It's very tricky.
Yeah. It sure doesn't mean that it's not beneficial for a SAR as well, though. I feel like sometimes it's used as a bit of a shield for certain information, or to make a search easier almost. It's, this is all, anything relating to this is all BAU.
That's what I was going
to
say. No, I think it's a great point. That often it's used as we won't deal with this lot because it's just this is just going to be BAU data, you know. Well, might not be in the comments.
I'm glad we're on the same line of thought.
But I think that what Cara says is quite right, isn't it? Where the individual isn't the focus of the data, of the information, then, you know, by definition, it's not, you know, biographical, and they're not, it's not about them because they're not the focus of it. But it might become the focus of it if that data was used for a different purpose. I think that's the point we're trying to make, isn't it? That it's hard to just have a blanket policy.
I don't think anything should be blanket. It's probably the lesson for all.
The
I
only
think.
Blanket you should have is a comfort blanket.
Yeah.
After you've finished all that redacting.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, what about case law then? I don't know if you've kind of, there's been quite a lot of case law around SARS, not necessarily employee SARS, but Mike Ashley was interesting, wasn't it? That's the most recent case as far as I know on SARS. But again, is there anything that we need to be aware of on recent case law? Or case law? I mean, the one that strikes me about employee stuff is the Deer v University of Oxford, where Dr. Deer was employed by University of Oxford, and she put in a SAR, and they said they searched for like 500,000 documents, and she said, you didn't find this though, and the courts ruled, well, it's a proportionate. I think that's where the first instance of it's a proportionate search came into being, I think. In the court.
I think what they say was that university didn't to search every archive server, wasn't it? Something that what they did was actually reasonable and proportionate. I think it's quite a good one.
I
for
mean,
the it's reasonable
a million
and proportionate.
Documents is yes. crazy anyway. Like, to have that much.
But this can happen, can it? It's
just yeah, like... no, of course.
Most of it was BAU, but you've been writing papers and doing research, you know.
Yeah.
It's all BAU. I read a quite interesting blog. I'll try and find the link to it, which was a quick blog by a law firm about key landmark cases in the field of SARS, starting with Durant and going through Edam V, the Information Commissioner, and Idian Etterham and Damon Dawson, and then Deer, and then Harrison Cameron, which we talked about a few months ago, and then Mike Ashley. So again, there's a few in there, and again, you read them through, and I like reading the transcripts of the cases, because you just get a view of what the judges actually say rather than someone's take on it in a blog. Yes, right, so we've got about 4 minutes left. Any final thoughts or anything we haven't covered off we want to talk about in more detail?
I had a question that, to be honest, I will take the chance to actually ask for your advice and insights on this. That is what actually Nia mentioned previously about the WhatsApp being social media, namely WhatsApp and team messages being used as, well, part of the SAR and part of the one of the tools that should be verified. And when we are talking about employees that use, for example, their personal devices as and WhatsApp is used and accepted, for example, by your organization, and would they use a personal device as part of the professional tool, and then a SAR comes in, and well, we know in the policy that WhatsApp is used, so I am just unsure about, for example, what the responsibility is to actually provide that and to carry out with our research. Is it obviously a conflict of interest between my privacy and my data protection, my privacy matters versus obviously your right as a controller and the organization control to actually have access to my phone to provide the information? So I just write to your feedback and insights on this.
I always wondered how they do the search. And I think WhatsApp sometimes for business comms is really, really, really complex. And sometimes I did have something in the notes about a case that I worked that referenced WhatsApp, who asked for WhatsApp communications, but it wasn't used by the business basically as an approved form of conduct or anything. And they wasn't, as far as I'm aware, from talking to the customer, they didn't use it for any sort of business communications. They might have had like personal WhatsApp groups and stuff like that, where they talk about work matters, sure, but in the context of work, I don't think it's helped. But to me, I think it's like, how do you do the search? Do you confiscate the phones? Obviously, these are personal phones in obviously
exactly.
your hypothetical
situation. No, you don't do it. Yeah, but you don't do it that way, you know. So the ICO's view is, if you do permit staff to hold personal data on their own devices, they may be processing that data on your behalf, in which case it's within the scope of the SAR. So you can't just rule it out that, our policy is you can't use it. If you know that they use it, then it could be that it's within scope. What I've done in the past is, you can't collect like 5,000 phones together to go through them. I think you have to go out to the employees and say, we've got this SAR, which again, there's confidentiality around that. We've got this SAR. Can you find, have you got any information, you know, that fits this information search criteria? And the, again, the most efficient way of doing it is saying, if you have come back to us, if you haven't, ignore this. Because if you start waiting for 5,000 responses, you're going to be tied up in red tape all year.
Doesn't it lead to issues with just like, for example, if someone has said something and they don't want it coming out in the SAR, just not saying anything at the same time and it not being like a reflective search?
And in the end of the day, the legal obligation is that they control it, isn't it? It's not up to the employee to actually probably carry out with the size and the control.
It's an imperfect. The whole thing is an imperfect situation.
Yeah, no, 100%. No, 100%.
You know, you have the best search tools, you know, and you're looking for something, you know, the thing that every search tool can find is stuff that's got a regular pattern to it, a name, a number, an email address, you know, something. But as soon as you start to get into, he said this about her. Who's he and who's her? And how is a search tool going to find that and say, this is about that data subject, therefore ought to be disclosed? It's just impossible to do it. So you're dealing with an imperfect situation in the first place. And I think you've got to accept that.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I think it's a great ending of this session. Saying it's the perfect system.
But Amy's spot on. As soon as AI gets clever enough,
well,
it will be able to
she's
read
not
the
wrong.
Context.
That'll probably be the next problem, I imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm just obviously mindful of time being that we have.
God, you're such a killjoy, Kate.
I know, I'm sorry.
Now, I have to say, it's been absolutely delightful to be back on the podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing the prep for it and doing the talk. So thank you very much, everyone who's joined. We've had a lot of people on, 150 people at one point, which is fantastic. So thanks, everyone, for your contributions and for joining us. We're interested in your feedback on the podcast and our move to go onto a kind of monthly format. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Kane. And special thanks to Nia for taking the time out to join us on this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
On this,
if I may, just making it just a quick reference. Obviously, everyone is more than welcome, as Nia did today, to participate in any session, not even as a host, just a guest. If they want to participate during the podcast, please be more than welcome to just send us an email or to Miles send an email demonstrating your interest in doing. We'll be more than happy to.
I believe it may be in like the content of like some comms that we send over in terms of for podcast stuff anyway. So I'm sure Miles will let us know if that is the case. But I've, you know, as Kate says, if anyone is interested, I think stuff will be coming out for people to sort of like declare their interest. Or if you think anybody else would be good on the podcast, you know, we always love having people on, and it's been really invaluable having Nia here today. So
yeah,
I really appreciate
that. Thank you very much, Nia. Hoping to see you in a second time.
Yeah, absolutely. We hope to see you again for sure.
Enjoy your weekend, everybody.
Bye bye. Thank you. Bye.
Bye guys.
Bye.